Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
What will life be like after the carbon age? And how will we get there? Julian Darley is the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of the book High Noon for Natural Gas. We'll talk to Julian about relocalization, energy farms, and peak oil. Julian Darley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
Well, there's so many things we could talk about, but I wanted to start with your own peak moment. When did you realize you wanted to work so much on peak oil and gas?
I started something called globalpublicmedia.com in 2001, and that came out of some work that I'd done at the BBC and I suppose about 10 to 15 years, making films and videos and other things in the realm of media all the way from London to Hollywood. And particularly what happened was after my master's in journalism in Texas, I focused my attention on the difficulties of trying to explain complex issues, particularly scientific issues, but not only those. Those are a particularly difficult subset. Also environmental issues, issues to do with ecosystem problems, and rather crudely, the sort of collapse of many ecosystems, which has been going on for a long time and is becoming more obvious. These things are actually very difficult for us to understand, even those who study them. And communicating the problems and the scales of the problems and the implications of the problems to a wide public so as to build a constituency that will, in the end, move politicians and business and so forth to understand and do something about these things is a very, very important task. So then, not many months after starting globalpublicmedia.com, which exists to this day with a huge archive now of interviews in audio and video about these matters of the environmental and ecosystem and other problems, I was lucky enough, in fact, through a local bookshop, which has now sadly gone out of business in Vancouver, where we were then living, somebody said, you must read this book. It's actually a book by Jeremy Rifkin. It was about, it was called The Hydrogen Economy. It was very interesting. I had my doubts about the hydrogen economy, and I've got a lot more now. But the essential reason that he was putting forward why we needed this supposed hydrogen economy was the forthcoming decline of oil. And to me, it was an extraordinary revelation because my second master's had been in social research and the environment, quite strongly focused on many environmental issues. And we'd touched on energy in a rather glancing fashion, even though this master's degree was actually in combination between a sociology department and a chemical engineering department. So there were grounds to think that the science would be handled in quite a rigorous way, and some of it was, but the energy part was sort of glossed over. And when I realized, because of the understanding that this forthcoming oil decline was a reality, and I think there's little doubt about it now, everything fell into place. My goodness, this is the missing link in all the studies that I've done over decades, not having energy at the center and core of things, leads you into a large amount, I think, of problematic thinking. I've studied philosophy in some depth, not in enormous rigor, but in some depth over the years, and it's been quite a lot of time on it. And it's amazing now to look back at it, how much philosophy, in my opinion, goes off the rails because there isn't an understanding of the kind of fundamentals of life. And the first fundamental of life, and perhaps the last fundamental, is energy. So it really does change everything when you put energy at the center of your thinking. And it brings a lot of other things, I think, into the right relative position. And you can understand what to do about some difficult problems a lot more easily. It doesn't make everything easy by any means. But I think it helps one to see that, well, this looks like a good idea on the face of it, and it would solve lots of problems. But when you actually see it from an energetic point of view, you realize, oh, wait a minute, you're assuming a boundless energy, a boundless cheap energy supply. That's a pretty bad idea, especially as our boundless cheap energy supply turns out to be not so boundless and not so cheap.
Yeah, a lot of Americans are finding that out right now the hard way at the pump, and I think there's more pain to come. But you seem to be ahead of the pack in saying, well, all right, this energy is limited. I've come to accept that. Now what? And so you've founded the Post-Carbon Institute. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Post-Carbon Institute was a direct result of the energy revelation, if you like. And essentially what happened was that we had global public media, and we started putting on in early 2003, we started putting on, they were sort of halfway between mini conferences and lectures, if you like, and it just didn't seem quite appropriate that these should be under the auspices of global public media. I should say that global public media was an attempt, however absurd it might sound, an attempt to do a sort of mini BBC on a shoestring because, as I say, I'd studied, done some research for about a year inside one of the most important programs, in my estimation, the BBC, around current affairs. And I held the BBC, and I do hold the BBC in high esteem and high regard, and I use that as one of the models. And the other model is the Open University, founded in the 1960s in Britain, which is an extraordinary institution, I think it remains so, which gives just about anybody the opportunity to take a degree, to take rigorous, systematic education, even if you, for whatever reason, didn't have access to it in your sort of your late adolescence and early 20s, which is the more common time. So thinking of the Open University, we started putting on these lectures, conferences, if you like, but I realized the BBC doesn't put on lectures and conferences. Other people do it, and the BBC filmed it, and it did start to feel odd. So that's why we created Post-Carbon Institute, which avowedly and openly is the vehicle for trying to analyze and disseminate in different ways. I'm thinking also policy communications, and also start working out responses. And that's been the path of the Post-Carbon Institute since then. And I've refined the mission into the barest few words possible, and that is the mission is to get society off fossil fuels fast. I could add on to that in decent, environmentally restorative ways, in socially decent ways, and so forth, without causing collapse, chaos, and so on and so forth. And those are very serious extra parameters. But the central task is to get society off fossil fuels fast. And that is what we try to do night and day, basically. And it's an ironic situation that as the price of oil goes on rising, no great surprise to anybody who accepts the peak oil situation, it both gives us much more opportunities and possibilities to get the job done, but it also is shortening the timeline dramatically because things are happening pretty fast now.
They are really rolling very quickly. Now, I found the Post-Carbon Institute seems like a nexus point for a series of movements, really, and I wanted to start with relocalize.net. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. The Relocalization Network, whose website is relocalize.net, formed in a similar way to Post-Carbon Institute. And in other words, it formed out of a need. It's as close as anything to having bubbled up from people just getting together and saying, but what can we do? In my book, High Noon for Natural Gas, published about 4 years ago, the last and by far the longest chapter is, but what else can we do? In other words, what else other than burn loads of hydrocarbons, you know, oil, gas, and coal? Fossil fuels. What else can we do? And that had been the question that we had been asking. We, in particular, the executive director of Post-Carbon Institute is Celine Rich, who, by total coincidence, happens to be my wife. And we'd been asking these questions for almost as long as we'd known each other, which is about 10 years now, is a sense of frustration, I think it's fair to say, that fine words were being emitted by people who thought very carefully about issues, but there didn't seem to be enough coherent action across a whole range of different societal actors, and citizens, and government, and business, and so forth. So we wanted to create ways, very practical ways, very strongly based on fact and careful theory and careful analysis, that people, I mean humans and institutions, could take actions quickly and effectively with the greatest possible effect and the least number of unpleasant side effects. So that's kind of what we set out to do.
And I noticed just lately in the UK Telegraph, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard says high energy prices might swing manufacturing back to America since we can't afford to ship all that stuff with oil and the tankers. So there could be a kind of cresting wave of realization about peak oil and the social implications. Are you seeing that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. Very interesting recently that it would appear that for the first time in many years, some steel products are actually cheaper in the United States of America if they're made in America than if they're made in China. I'm talking about raw steel, as it were, rolled steel and things like that, because the shipping costs are now becoming so high that even without carbon taxes and so forth, which are a difficult area and not necessarily existent, the prices of shipping and transport are now getting so high that it's starting what we've called relocalization, going back to a time when things were made more locally. So yes, in fact, it's already started. And if you think for a minute about the fact that, wait a minute, steel being cheaper to produce in America than producing it in China and sending it back to America, that I think is momentous, and I think we've only just begun to see these effects. One of the things that I think, one of the unfortunate side effects for now is that manufacturing will be repatriated from the Far East back towards the North American continent, in the case of North America. The trouble is, it's most likely to go back to maquiladoras just south of the Texan and that border there, Arizona, Texas, and so forth, into the north section of Mexico, south of the Rio Grande. And these maquiladoras are very unpleasant places where very poor working conditions pertain, very poor pay, much pollution, and so forth. But, of course, it's cheap to do that. So that's a bad side effect. It would be much better if goods intended for Canadians were made in Canada, wherever possible. Those for Americans were made in America, preferably as local to where regionally as well, and the same for Mexico. On the other hand, even if things do go back to unfortunate situations in these maquiladoras, at least it's close. It's not 8,000 miles away where it would be extremely difficult to police or check or anything else. In other words, if the United States wanted to do something about the maquiladora situation, it's very much easier if you're just a few miles from the border of Texas than if you're thousands of miles away, in a much more cognate language, i.e. Spanish rather than Far Eastern language. So in that sense, it may well be progress, and if people decide that they want to have decent and better working conditions and the whole thing done in a much more reasonable way, then it can be done much more easily. So I think it's important to note that. But in general, it's an inevitable move as oil costs go up and transport costs go up. But it's just a warning to say we could do this thing better and we could do this thing worse. And so one of the things that Post Carbon Institute tries to do is to work out sensible, including economically sensible, pathways so that we can do things better, more regionally, more locally, and not revert to things which are pretty unfortunate for just about everybody except a few who profit at the top.
Well, another aspect of that, too, is localized energy, and you talk about energy farms. What is an energy farm?
Well, as we conceptualize it, an energy farm is a place that tries to be energy net positive, in other words, to export energy. And we see this, one of the special characteristics of an energy farm, the way we conceptualize it, is that that energy farm is trying to use as few petroleum inputs as possible. So what you're trying to do is produce as much renewable energy with as few non-renewable inputs as possible. One day we're pretty well going to have to manage like that. I'm not saying it's going to happen tomorrow, but part of what Post-Carbon Institute does is tries to prepare and work out scenarios in which there really won't be any petroleum and really won't be any fossil fuels. It's not going to happen tomorrow. I'm not pretending it is. But, for instance, if you realize that having to manage a society with no petroleum, no fossil fuels, that means no coal at all, was going to take, let's say, 60 years of preparation so that there wasn't absolute chaos and very unfortunate circumstances and so forth, then if you realized, oh, wait a minute, we may be completely out of all fossil fuels by 2100, and it's going to take, well, let's say you worked out that was going to take 100 years, then you realize that you better start doing this in earnest in the year 2000. Well, we didn't. So you see what I mean? If this thing is going to take a long time, and we'd like to be as little pain and done as decently as possible. So this is one of the reasons why I think we need to start modeling some pretty rigorous conditions. And that, I think, will also help us to make the transition faster, because we may make some, I hope we'll make some very useful discoveries in the process and realize, hey, wait a minute, we can do this with no fossil fuels at all. It wasn't nearly as difficult as we thought. It makes some economic sense. We can do it in an environmentally good fashion, hopefully even restorative fashion. Why don't we do that much sooner rather than later? And if we get going on that research now, or better still, yesterday, then we're much more likely to find those kinds of things soon, and that could be a huge benefit to us, rather than waiting till 20X, whatever we think it might be, and then discovering, oh, crumbs, we should have started this 50 years ago.
Well, and I think another driver of that is the ream of scientists who are coming out now and saying, well, look, we've only got 7 or 8 years at the most to get these big changes underway, or we're going to suffer a lot more fires and floods and rising seas and all that sort of thing. So that's another driver, is just the climate change aspect.
Climate change should be a much bigger driver than it is. What I'm saying is that I think, and I have thought for decades, that climate change is a tremendously powerful driver. When are we actually going to see really serious change? One of the interesting things is you can say, well, actually, U.S. gasoline consumption appears to have peaked in 2005 and appears to be on the decline now. And indeed, the number of miles traveled in America, the total number of miles traveled in the personal vehicle, is actually now declining quite quickly. But it's not because people are worried about climate change, or rather they might be worried about climate change, but that's not what's causing them to change their behavior. It's high gasoline prices, average gasoline price well over $4 now across America, and I think it's about $4.50 here in California. So what's starting to happen is that peak oil and the high and rising prices associated with that, for particularly gasoline but other things, are becoming a kind of de facto climate policy. And what would be really good is if climate and peak communities came together and said, instead of just being driven around by the market, as it were, we should actually get together and start developing policies which take into account both peak and climate. And this is something that we're still in the early days on. And I am hopeful that as it becomes more apparent that peak oil is real and that we are either have entered or we are about to enter the phase of global oil production decline, that I hope will concentrate minds and communities into thinking about, now what should the combined policy be? Because if you're lucky, peak oil will be great for climate. There's plenty of ways in which peak oil could be bad for climate if we just let things run, including, for instance, just burning more coal. For instance, the coal-to-liquids policy is a really bad idea from the climate, bad idea from the point of view of losing coal miners' lives and mercury emissions and dozens of wrecking of mountains and so forth. I mean, coal mining, collection, production of coal is a bad idea, full stop. So that's one of the, I'm hoping, and we're working to try and make that one of the outcomes of these rising prices and the slowly dawning understanding of peak oil, because it is only slowly dawning. I'm reasonably sure only a fraction of the populace, both in North America and the world, have any idea about peak oil. So that dawning will help us to make much better climate policy, and that climate understandings will help us to make better peak oil responses.
We are talking with Julian Darley, the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of High Noon for Natural Gas, among many other things. He's a prolific writer and speaker found all over. Julian, another interesting tool you bring to the table is more subtle, I think. Most of the mainstream media keeps pushing the idea that some new technology, a car or a battery or something, just around the corner, will save us from declining and dangerous fossil fuels. But you've suggested that social changes, not technology, might be a real way to adapt to this new reality. Could you explain that and maybe give us an example?
Yes. I think it's pretty clear that social and cultural changes, including changes in what we believe about the world and how we should behave, are the real key to this. Now, this isn't to say that some technological changes won't be very helpful. We are a creature that can't exist. Most of us can't exist more than 5 minutes, practically, without technology. I mean, almost everybody is wearing clothes at one time or another. People in Canada are using technology all the time for many months of the year to stay warm, as in many other parts of the world. You know, we are absolutely a creature that needs tools. That's how we've got where we are, for better or for worse. So I am not at all dismissing the need for technology and the fact that we've been using it for at least 2 million years and very sophisticated technology for quite a long time. But there is, as far as we can understand, the science points irreducibly in the direction of the fact that without fossil fuels, we just cannot run society the way we've become used to, especially in the industrialized world. So big changes are going to happen. It will be much easier to do these by social and cultural changes and then manage with the science and technology that we can get that we can develop based on a much reduced demand. So this social and cultural change, what's at the bottom of it is the need to reduce demand. If we can greatly reduce demand, there is a very good chance that we could do a good deal about reducing our carbon dioxide outputs and hopefully doing something about climate change. I separate the two up because it's not self-evident now that we can go fast enough to reverse some changes. But by reducing our energy demand dramatically will almost certainly help a lot of other problems that we've caused. You asked for an example.
Well, like sharing, for example.
Well, excellent. Well, maybe we could come right to something that we are engaged in, which is both a mixture of cultural and technology, and that is car sharing. We are pioneering what may well be the first solar car share in the world. Here in Sebastopol, in California, we have 6 all-electric vehicles. 5 of them are trucks because where we are in moderately rural Sonoma County, a lot of people have a demand for small trucks for moving things around, a few yards of soil, all kinds of things that need to get moved around on an occasional basis. And so many people here, as a for instance, it's not true in all parts of the world, but many people here own a sort of dilapidated truck which just about runs, for these occasional visits to go and get this, that, and the other, which they wouldn't want to put in their first car. I mean, people have a lot of cars here. And so what we're trying to offer is a kind of multi-pronged opportunity to greatly reduce consumption of fossil fuels, in this case gasoline, without losing mobility and utility, possibly even gaining it in that as you develop a car share, you can offer many different kinds of vehicles. So what we have here is a number of electric vehicles which we have built into a car sharing system, not dissimilar to the one in Vancouver and in many other places in North America. The big difference is that they're nearly all electric, which imposes a lot of extra difficult demands on the user because they have to be filled, if you like, with electricity, charged with electricity. So the first thing is, by sharing almost anything, you can reduce the overall demand. It's a very good discipline as well. It's good for building aspects of society and culture. You have to coordinate. You have to work with other people. You have to be, to put it bluntly, a rather good citizen, because if you share something, you take it away, you use it, you must return it to the place where you got it from normally, and you must return it in good condition. If you're either late or it's broken or damaged or dirty in some way, you inconvenience the next person. And so it really teaches you kind of stewardship, husbandry, being a good neighbor, being a good citizen. It brings you back into that necessity, and we can extend that out into the rest of society and nature and ecology. So there are some tremendous benefits by sharing. That already has an extremely extremely large effect in reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled, reducing carbon emissions, reducing the amount of gasoline, diesel, or biodiesel consumed. It's approximately 50%. So once you bring in a car sharing system, if you were able to bring it in to a great extent in a town, city, place, you could have an enormous effect overnight. In fact, to think back to that G8 communique, they're calling for a 50% reduction by 2050. If you brought in a car share system, even a fossil fuel powered car share system, you could get to that 50% tomorrow morning. I mean, it's pretty astonishing. It will do it, isn't it? I think the number is about 47%. But to anybody's, you know, that's good enough. That's 50%. Now, if you bring in the electric part, you can actually go much better because electricity is so much better for powering vehicles. In fact, it's 3 or 4 times more efficient. So you could further reduce that dramatically. Then if you were to power your vehicles with renewable electricity, ultimately, renewable electricity is virtually all solar powered one way or another, so direct solar PV or wind, or in some parts of Canada, there's lots of renewable electricity available for water. Then you've got a situation where you could bring your greenhouse gas emissions and your fossil fuel consumption down to nearly zero. There's embedded energy and implied emissions in the actual devices themselves. Vehicles are not negligible things to produce. They require lots of materials and so forth. Although, let me point out, if you make them much lighter, you can reduce all kinds of impacts in that way, and it makes them much lower in their energy demands as well. And when you start doing electric vehicles, you become sort of an all-out battle to get the weight of the vehicle down. You want to get the resistance down, and you also ideally, and here's a cultural shift, you need to persuade people to drive more slowly, demand less acceleration, and they drive lighter vehicles. That all makes an absolutely huge difference, especially electric vehicles. So this idea of a solar car share is revolutionary in the sense that it could bring emissions and fossil fuel impacts consumption down to nearly zero very, very fast indeed. But I must say any car share will bring down these impacts by about 50% more or less as soon as you can get it going at scale. So I think this idea of a solar car share is very exciting. There are a lot of challenges. Even with that, solar photovoltaic is very, very expensive, and you may need up to 100 panels, for instance, to regularly charge a vehicle, an electric vehicle in the car share, a main highway vehicle that will go 60 or 70 miles an hour. That's a lot of panels. I mean, that's probably $200,000 when you finish paying for all the installation and the associated electrical peripheral and so forth. That's a lot of money right now, and it's clearly not economically viable for an individual to do that right now. It certainly won't make up the savings probably in one's lifetime, even if electricity prices keep going up. However, we think it's a powerful pioneering idea, and one of the things that a non-profit institute like Post Carbon Institute is set up to do is to do some research, do things which don't make economic sense now, but make great social, societal, ecological sense.
You know, Julian, I think that some of these things are coming faster than we think. I've seen a model of a Volkswagen built in Germany that gets 235 miles per gallon, and it is ultralight, as you've suggested. They were going to make it in 2012. Now they say they may put out at least a few thousand of them in 2010. And it's fossil fuel, but my, that's a lot of mileage.
Also, big difference.
Well, listeners, you can get the idea. We've got a huge pool of information and leading ideas here from Julian Darley, I should say. And to find out more, you can go to postcarbon.org or globalpublicmedia.com. Julian, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find all our interviews, programs, and recorded speeches free at our website, ecoshock.org.